This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. More than 80 years ago, some powerful people had a dream. They wanted a national park in the mountains of Virginia. But to make that dream come true, something had to be done about thousands of non-powerful people who were in the way. Etta Snow was one of those thousands.
Where had you lived in the park?
In Greene County, Virginia.
Was that in the mountains in Greene County?
Near Scalon Drive.
The powerful people had their way. Etta, her family, and hundreds of other families across eight Virginia counties were forced from their homes so the national park could be created. You know it as Shenandoah. Today, several efforts are underway to make sure the story of those families is honored. Those efforts will be our focus right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. It has been referred to by some as the Great Blue Ridge Removal. During the 1930s, thousands of people pushed out of their homes across eight Virginia counties throughout the Blue Ridge Mountains, forced to radically alter their way of life so that a national park could be created. Even many Virginians do not know the story, and you'd be hard-pressed to find it in many school children's American history books. A number of people are working to change that, and we'll meet some of them in a moment. But if this is a story with which you are familiar, maybe it even affected someone in your family, or if you just find that you have questions as our discussion proceeds, you are invited to join us by phone at 888-WMRA-TALK. Here in the Insight Studio to help, Claire Comer, who works in the Shenandoah National Park as a park service interpretive specialist, Mark Purrington, who serves as digital content coordinator for James Madison University's Carrier Library, which now houses the Shenandoah National Park Oral History Collection. More about that in a moment. Plus, Bill Henry, a volunteer with a group that calls itself the Blue Ridge Heritage Project. Thank you all for making time for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Well, Mark, actually, Bill, let me go to you first. If you met someone from another part of the country who had never heard of the Shenandoah National Park until they, let's say, just recently came to Virginia for a visit, and when they did learn about the park, they also heard that there was a strange backstory to how this particular national park got created. They knew that you knew a lot about that story, and they asked you to tell it to them. What would you tell them?
Well, I'd like to say that the park was created at a time early in the National Park Service's history, and it followed up on the creation of the Western National Parks when they were formed. Basically, the land that was Yosemite or Yellowstone before the park was owned by the federal, was controlled by the federal government. And as these parks got going, people, the government officials around the country started looking at the economic impact of the park in their neighborhood, in the neighborhoods. And there were a lot of people that would like to have a national park. And so there was some pressure to build a national park east of the Mississippi where it was accessible to a larger amount of the population. And so the Blue Ridge became a targeted area where we, the government started thinking about where could we put a park. And so in Virginia and other communities up and down the Blue Ridge, there was a little bit of competition to try to get a park in their area because of the tourists that it would bring in, the dollars that it would bring in. And so there was a strong support for the national park in the Luray area, and they began to start, you know, lobbying a number of people of influence, either in the state or the local state or local officials, began to talk about what can we do to get a park here. And so there was so much pressure put on the government by so many communities that we ended up having two national parks created in the Blue Ridge, the Great Smoky Mountain National Park and Shenandoah National Park. But when the parks out west were created, because it was government land, there weren't people living there. So the government just said, okay, here we go. But when they decided to build a park here in the east, the land was privately owned. And so they had to figure out how are we going to handle this. There was no precedent for it. And the federal government also didn't have money budgeted for the park to buy the land. So they said to the state of Virginia, if you want a park, you're going to have to get the land and give it to us. And so the state of Virginia stepped up and said, okay, here we go. Began to look around and got the right to use, got the ability to use the power of eminent domain. And for people who weren't willing to sell to the government, not very many people were, then their land was condemned and they were given sometimes fair market value, but it was hard to establish a fair market value for that kind of land. And so these people that were living in the mountains, some of them did move away willingly. Some of them were carried out bodily, not very many, but there were a lot of people that they were actually removed from their plant, their land, displaced, might be a more politically correct term. But
don't be politically correct. and this was across 8 counties.
Correct.
Can you name the counties off the top of your head, Bill Henry? I bet you can.
Yes,
you?
I can.
Will help.
Albemarle, Augusta, Greene, Madison, Rockingham, Page, Rappahannock, and Warren. Is that 8? Good.
And there were how many people living in the area that would become the Shenandoah National Park that had to leave their homes in order for that park to be created?
I don't know an exact number. I've read that that it's difficult to tell how many people there were living in the area because...
But there seems to be general agreement that the number was in the thousands?
Yeah.
At the time of the establishment of the park, there were about 465 families still living on park land. But that number is really, I mean, that's families.
But that's after the state of Virginia took over the land and started using its power of eminent domain to tell people they had to leave.
No, not long after. There was a process that went over about 10 years. And there were 2 reductions in the boundary, in the legal boundary. So the final boundary took in a little over 1,081 tracts of land. But it is a very difficult thing to put a number on because part of that, the middle boundary, there were 2 boundary reductions. After the first boundary reduction, they applied eminent domain to that area. So those people were affected, although never, they didn't have to leave, but there may have been some people who went ahead and left as knowing that this is coming. Then the final boundary, those people were displaced. But you don't know how many of them in that 10 years said, okay, I'm out of here, instead of waiting until the actual establishment. So the number probably is definitely in the thousands. I mean, if you just take the 465 families, that probably accounts for...
At the end of the process.
Yes, at the end of the process. So there's no way really to account for this. And you also don't know other reasons that people were leaving the mountain. You know, there were other reasons that people may have started moving out too. So it's really hard to say this exact number of people were displaced. We use that 465 because that's how many families were left. But, you know, it was greater than that, the number of families that were affected and are still affected because of that eminent domain.
Mark Purrington, digital content coordinator for James Madison University's Carrier Library. Feel free to push back at me throughout the hour because I know you hate to be thought of as an expert on this history. You're not a historian, but you have had the experience of, and we'll talk at some length about how the library at James Madison ended up with this collection a little bit later in the show. You've had the experience of listening to well over 100 interviews that were recorded during the 1960s and 1970s, the survivors of these families that were still around, who did lose their homes so that the park could be created, and you've looked into the story. So underscoring that you're not an historian and you're not an expert, from your point of view, from what you've learned about this period, what else needs to be said to somebody who's never heard this story before so they have a complete picture?
All right. Well, just to touch on the previous point of the families, one of the things that comes out in the interviews in the Shenandoah National Park Oral History Collection is that at that time, as was quite normal everywhere in the country, these were fairly large families. A lot of people, remarked that they had 10, 12 or more siblings. So when you say 500 families, you could really be talking about a significant number of people.
And there's a story about, and I know, Mark, that you have some sense about this because you and I have chatted about this before. As a non-historian, you certainly are aware of some of the efforts that were made by those fairly powerful interests who really wanted a park created in the Blue Ridge Mountains.
Absolutely. It's
to
pretty
color the picture of who these people were so that it would be easier to accept the idea of moving them out of the mountains.
Exactly. There was a very well orchestrated, we'd call it a propaganda campaign today, portraying these people as very backwards, ignorant, almost savages. There was a famous quote saying these people lived so far back in the hills that they still spoke Elizabethan English. A report or book that was commissioned called The Hollow Folk makes the claims that these people had no community government, no organized religion, little social organization wider than that of the family. And another quote says that the ragged children until 1928 had never seen the flag or heard the Lord's Prayer. And the facts just don't bear that out. The people in these interviews certainly could disprove these false claims.
Is it possible, Mark Purrington from James Madison University, librarian, that the idea of the ignorant hillbilly that still exists in somewhat in popular culture in our country today got started in a way with this campaign to create this park?
It very much is still alive today. But, just going back and looking at what came out of Hollywood, following this, you had, Ma and Pa Kettle, you've had the Clampets, you've had Deliverance, of course, really was the one that put the nail in the Mountain People's portrayal. And even today, I don't know, shows like Duck Dynasty or whatnot, that they just portray Southern and Mountain People as completely inept and lazy and shiftless, when it took a lot of work, a lot of hard work to make a living in the mountains in those days. And these people were entirely self-sufficient, or almost entirely self-sufficient. The interviewees report that they would go to the local, there were a lot of little general stores scattered throughout the mountains, and basically they would go for coffee, salt, sugar, and kerosene. And in the fall, they would go in to buy shoes for the winter. But basically, they grew their own food, they raised their own animals and butchered them and preserved that food for the year. And again, if you're talking about people with, 10 or 12 kids, that's quite a job. It wasn't a lazy person's way of life.
Bill Henry, the Blue Ridge Heritage Project is in part dedicated to the effort of sort of recovering the reputations of those families that were besmirched.
Well, I'm sure that's going to be a part of our project. We're primarily involved with trying to set up a monument, and actually a series of 8 monuments, one in each of the counties where land was taken for the park, to kind of bring out the truth of the story. Going back to your original question about what would a person who didn't know anything about Shenandoah National Park need to know, we want somebody who's coming to the park, and we do have millions of people that come to the park and literally from around the world, and most of them never learn much about the backstory. But we want them to be able to understand the history of the park from a point of view that this is important, that this is where we are with the park today, that we have the park because these people sacrificed so much. And we wanted to try to honor that sacrifice, not only for the families, but also for the visitors.
The oral history collection, now housed at James Madison University, is based on amateur audio recordings done in the 1960s and 70s. Some of it's a little difficult to hear, but it's still wonderful. And we're going to take a listen in just a moment. Our guests on this edition of Virginia Insight, National Park Service interpretive specialist Claire Comer, who works at the Shenandoah National Park, retired schoolteacher Bill Henry, who is one of the organizers of the group that calls itself the Blue Ridge Heritage Project, plus Mark Purrington, digital content coordinator for the James Madison University's Carrier Library, which houses the Shenandoah National Park Oral History Collection. My name's Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. We're talking about something that is sometimes referred to as the Great Blue Ridge Removal. What happened to thousands of people who lived in the Blue Ridge Mountains in the 1930s so that a beautiful national park could be created? Let's get to that collection, Mark Purrington. Tell us some of the backstory of what you now have on tape at James Madison University.
Well, as you mentioned, Tom, a lot of these recordings, we have about 135 tape recordings that we received from the National Park back in 2000. Most of these were done by amateurs. The bulk of them were done by a woman named Dorothy Noble Smith from Page County, whose name may be familiar. She used to write a column for newspaper in Page County, I think, in the 70s and 80s. And she was working on a book called Recollections, The People of the Blue Ridge Remember. And this was in the late 70s. And most of the people she was interviewing were in their late 70s or 80s at the time. And she spoke to them on a number of topics, but mostly wanted to know how they lived before the park came. And so the collection deals with a wide variety of day-to-day activities, you know, farming and food preservation, the different local industries of the mountain people. And also, I kind of hesitate to use the term mountain people because I think it's almost stereotypical, but this was the term that they tended to use about themselves in the interviews. So I guess we'll stay with it. They talked about local characters such as George Freeman Pollock and his Skyland resort. And several interviews from Madison County talk about President Herbert Hoover, who built a Rapidan camp up there as a getaway just after his election in 1928. And they report, you know, seeing Herbert Hoover out fishing, or I guess Mrs. Hoover was very fond of children. So it was not unusual for these kids to go and visit the Hoovers.
The flavor of the interviews, and they can be accessed online now, we should point out, and we have a connection to that on our Virginia Insight page at WMRA.org, seems to me to, especially with, was it Dorothy Smith?
Dorothy Smith.
That the intent of Ms. Smith and some of the other interviewers really was to kind of, can I say rectify the image of these people? Because the kinds of questions that are asked and certainly the answers that are given show a lot about how complex the society was and how hardworking these people were and how in so many ways, Mark Purrington, as I listen to them, they don't sound much different than my grandparents or my great-grandparents who lived in rural areas of the U.S. back at the turn of the last century and into the 1930s.
Exactly. That's one of the things that comes across, is that just how normal and average these people were at the time. As I told you the other day, when I was reading the transcripts, I'm from northern New England, and when I was reading the transcripts, I could hear my grandparents and their friends speaking in the reply. It was only when I listened to the tapes that I realized that
They had slightly different accents, but in Massachusetts.
Basically, they had the same concerns, they had the same goals, and a lot of the same skills. They were entirely self-sufficient.
And you go back 80 years or 100 years in the U.S., and the vast majority of the population lived in rural areas. Mm-hmm. Some type of farming was the norm, subsistence off the land, and that's what many of these people were doing. But there is a fellow by the name of Austin Judd,
mm-hmm.
who was interviewed by the woman that you mentioned, Dorothy Smith, and early in the interview, she's asking him about the family store that his dad started.
Right.
And I want to play a bit of this tape. He mentions just before this part of the audio starts that he, Austin himself, was born in 1906. And he remembers that his father had the store in one room of their house. And then a few years later, he was able to move it to another building. And then he continues with this description.
People, everybody would come to the store, all the jewel holler, all up out of jewel holler. Shank holler, a lot of them out of shank holler. So we went back to Park Headquarters and then up in the shank holler.
Mm-hmm. How would they get here?
Walk.
They'd walk?
Walk.
What would they buy?
What did they buy?
Yeah.
Well, they bought just anything at that time. They'd buy sugar, coffee, and
salt.
Things that you had to have. What, the good sugar, the coffee, what else?
Salt. Huh? Kerosene. Huh? Kerosene.
I think they would buy kerosene. In gallon cans, I think maybe they'd buy kerosene. Yeah.
Flour.
They bought flour. Yeah. They bought flour.
Now, how would they pay for this?
Well, they some of them had money, and some of them didn't. Some of them, they would charge it. Dad wrote an account with them. And he knew. Some of them he wouldn't, some of them he would. Now, he knew them. And lots of times, old man Madison Corbin, he was about the head one there in Nichols Hollow. And he was an honest man. You know what I'm talking about being honest. He was.
Yeah.
And a lot of times people would want credit, and Mr. Corbin would have to write a note to Dad to let him have it, that he would stand good for it. Yeah.
He did that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
That's a way
people
do. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
They help each other. It did, yes.
From the Shenandoah National Park Oral History Collection. If you've just joined us, we have here with us in the Inside Studio Mark Purrington, Digital Content Coordinator for James Madison University's Carrier Library, where that collection is now housed. Bill Henry, one of the organizers of the group, the Blue Ridge Heritage Project, and from the National Park Service, Park Interpretive Specialist Claire Comer. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We heard just a couple of times, and right at the end there, Mark Purrington, the voice of Mrs. Judd, Austin Judd's wife. But from looking at the transcripts, I didn't see her first name. I don't know if you know.
No, that's one of the great beauties of these interviews. It may have the title interview with Austin Judd, but Mrs. Judd was there. A lot of times there'll be other family members in the background who are chipping in information above and beyond Dorothy Smith's questions.
But that last thing that we heard Mrs. Judd say is something that comes up again and again and again in the different interviews. She said, yeah, they'd help each other.
That was a very, that point came up quite a bit during the interviews.
You really get an image of a close-knit, vibrant community, even though that these are people who often live where their nearest neighbor is miles away.
It is. I think a number of tight-knit communities would be more accurate. I think there was some competition between the Hollows and whatnot. According to what the people have said, it was often unwise to go courting somebody else's Hollow if you weren't from around there, according to these interviews. But another point that Austin Judd touched on was that there were a number of these small stores scattered throughout the region, and it was often a two-way interaction. The mountain people would bring a lot of things to the store, especially things like chestnuts.
Yeah, there's a wonderful selection here on Chestnuts. We had to sort of pick and choose because the audio quality, when you're listening to it, either at the library or online, you kind of have to strain to hear. And unfortunately, when they get translated over the radio, it's even harder to hear some of it. But the thing about the Chestnuts, about people from miles around would bring Chestnuts to the store to trade for goods. And then Austin's father would collect these, and a few times a year he'd ship them off to some city, and that's part of how he made his living.
Exactly.
Because people didn't buy chestnuts. They grew them themselves in the mountains.
The chestnut was a huge cash crop for the mountain people, and a lot of people report that's how they would buy their winter shoes. Well, in the 1920s, the chestnut blight came into the valley and killed almost every chestnut tree around. In a matter of, what, months or years? It was very quick.
Over a period of very few years.
It went very quickly. And, of course, now these people had no – there's a lot of people report that they didn't get their winter shoes that year because of the blight. There's a lot of poignant stories in there.
Claire Como from the National Park Service, we do have more audio that we will be able to listen to in a bit here. But as you were hearing Austin Judd talk about his family experience and his father's store – did it bring anything to mind for you?
Very similar to my upbringing as well. I'm a local, Page County. I know Jewel Hollow. I know the Jenkins family. And that's very similar to my upbringing. So, yes.
And your family had land. Was it your maternal great-grandfather several times removed, the Long family?
My father's.
Your father's.
Yes, my father's family.
But they, for many generations, dating back to sometime in the 1700s, land that was lost when the national park was created.
They had, my family had grazed land in the national park. We still own our home farm, which has been in the family since 1732. That's in the valley. So while, yes, we lost land both to the Shenandoah National Park and to the National Forest in the Massanutten, we didn't lose a home. Now, we had a tenant farmer who had been there for generations, as was the generations of my family. And he, of course, not only lost his home, but received no compensation because he didn't actually own anything. So that was another kind of tragedy for many of the people who lived there. If they didn't have a clear title to their land, in many cases, they were compensated for improvements that they may have made, orchards or buildings or that sort of thing, but they didn't receive compensation for the land. So that made it doubly difficult for some families.
Bill Henry from the Blue Ridge Heritage Project, where did these families go once they were forced by government edict to leave their homes?
Well, some of the families were able to establish a place outside of the park, and they might have been able to buy a piece of land and get a new home site going. Some of the people moved in with relatives, or whether it was local or out of state. But then there were a lot of people that were left. The number I think that you mentioned were the 400 and some families that were left in the park at the creation of the park. And some of them really didn't have any options. They didn't have family outside the park, or they had lived in the mountains all their life and maybe just didn't know how to make their way outside of the park. And so some of the families were actually moved to sites that were created by the federal government under the New Deal's Resettlement Administration. This was an organization that was set up to try to help people all across the country. Most people are familiar with the Grapes of Wrath and the people from Oklahoma that went out west, or the other states that went out west to California thinking that they were going to find work. And indeed, there were in some places jobs for the people to have, but they ended up in places where there might not have been jobs. And so the Resettlement Administration was trying to move these people where there were jobs. And
do I understand correctly, Bill Henry, that there were 7 resettlement locations where many of the families were sent?
Yes, the Resettlement Administration established, bought land.
And these were homes, were the actual homes or apartments?
They were small homes, and they were equipped with modern conveniences for of the time.
But
and
it was a tr- a fairly significant change in lifestyle for people who had lived off the land with their nearest neighbor sometime miles away. Now you had people living next door to each other, not exactly in a suburban tract, but the only way really to make a living was to get a job from somebody else.
Well, actually, the resettlement homesteads were little farms, or what we might call today a farmette. There was a house, often with a couple of outbuildings, and then they had land that they could, it was cropland that they could graze or raise crops on, mostly for trying to recreate the type of farming that they did, although it was very different because it was flat, you know, relatively flat land. It wasn't in the mountains. You did have the neighbors nearby. And in Greene County, they actually tried a different type of operation. They put the people in a village setting, and the farmland was out around the villages, almost a communal setup. And that was probably the least successful of all of these. But the people had the opportunity to try to buy their property, buy the land that they were resettled on. And many of them probably stayed a while and then didn't like it, maybe moved someplace else where they could be closer to relatives or something. Some of the houses are actually still in existence today, near Elkton, up in Rappahannock County. You can still see the original houses that were built. Most of them have been improved on quite a bit.
But Bill, let me interrupt you for a second because we are going to hit the break here in a moment, and I want to let anybody listening hear a little bit of this interview with Deaconess Hutton. And then we'll tell you about her when we get back from the break.
Did you hear any stories from any of them, how they arrived here? Families from generations back.
Of course, the story is that they came from when Spotswood came over the Spotswood Trail down and looked into the valley. That from then on, people began to come across the hill into the valley. There are also other stories told that people came up the valley from Roanoke Way up this way and from Alexander Way down to the valley because of its beauty and of its loveliness and its richness of soil and atmosphere and all.
Mm-hmm.
So it got populated in the valley, and then the people pressing on from the valley up this way to go over the mountain. But they would get up into these communities, these little hollows, and just settle there.
Mm-hmm. Did they do a lot of visiting back and forth back in the mountains?
Among themselves, you mean here in one community?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. In fact, everybody, the minute anybody had a sickness or a sorrow or anything, everybody else took something to them and stayed and sat up at nights with them and mourned with them and loved them.
Oh, that's
it. Is a beautiful spirit.
Yes.
It doesn't make any difference what happens. Everybody will come to you.
Yeah.
If I should call in the middle of the night for help, I'd get it.
Mm-hmm. Did they get together evenings and sing?
And they had sewing bees and quilting bodies.
Sewing and quilting, yes.
And they did sing because they had quite a little, well, after the mission workers came, they had quite a little band up there.
Oh.
And a very musical. The people themselves are musical.
They,
and many
when they
of them
played.
Play by ear.
Yeah.
The young man plays the organ, plays by ear, but he plays beautifully.
Uh-huh.
Just beautiful.
Bill Henry is one of the organizers of the group that calls itself the Blue Ridge Heritage Project. Mark Purrington is digital content coordinator for the James Madison University Carrier Library, which now houses the Shenandoah National Park Oral History Collection. Claire Comer is a National Park Service interpretive specialist at the Shenandoah National Park. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. So just before we had to go to that break, Mark Purrington, from this remarkable
audio collection, these interviews done in the 1960s and early 1970s on amateur recorders. We were hearing from someone that everybody knew as Deaconess Hutton.
That's right.
Anything that we need to know in addition to what we were hearing from her on tape?
Mary Hutton was a deaconess in the Episcopal Church, and she ran the Pine Grove Episcopal Mission up in the mountains, which, according to a lot of the people interviewed, played a key role because the churches would send bundles of clothing and shoes and whatnot that Deaconess Hutton would distribute or sell for a very, you know, small price to the locals. So it was a way of goods coming in. Very popular. People couldn't say enough good things about her. Mary Hutton was stricken by polio and was wheelchair bound, which in the rough terrain of the mountains makes it even more extraordinary that she was able to get out and about with the people so much. And there are a number of stories of local men, you know, they would just pick her up, chair and all, and carry her wherever she needed to go to get over the rough spots. She said she had a mission at Christmas time. She wanted to see that everyone she could reach, regardless of age, get some sort of a Christmas present, whether it was a pair of socks or an orange or something. That was quite a big undertaking. So there's a lot of fond memories of Deaconess Hutton.
Claire Comer from the National Park Service, I want to apologize to you, although I think Congress is at least partially responsible. As you may know, in preparation for the talk show that we do, each talk show, we do extensive pre-interviews and research beforehand. We were not allowed to have a pre-interview conversation with you about your work because Congress said you could not work during the point in time when they furloughed so-called non-essential federal employees. Congratulations on being back at work, by the way.
Thanks for whatever you did to have them make that determination last night, Tom, so I could be here today.
But that means that you and I have not spoken at the same length that that Bill and Mark and I have. And I'm not as familiar with your work as I would like to be. But it is my understanding that a large part of your work involves telling people the actual history of how the park was created with no blemishes covered up. And in fact, it has to be said, as I hope we stressed at the top of the hour, that the effort to besmirch the reputation of people who lived in the mountains, to make it easier for people to have sympathy, the general public, with the idea of moving them out, and the push of the powerful people who wanted a national park created in the Blue Ridge Mountains, that none of that was the Park Service doing that. And for some 20 years now, the Park Service has had a quite admirable record of trying to tell this story.
Not to my knowledge, and I've done quite a lot of research in this. And one of the reasons
When you say not to my knowledge, you mean not to my knowledge, did the Park Service have anything to do with the campaign against these people? Yeah.
You know, he spoke of the study that's the totally, completely, ridiculously erroneous study that was done. And we don't know who that was commissioned by or if it was commissioned or if it was something that they did on their own. So, no, I've not ever been able to put a finger on who did that. And I've suffered from that having come from this area just as much as other people. But I think that what we have done in the last 20 years, 23 years, I was hired specifically to help tell this story because of my familiarity with the story in the area and my family history. And so we started doing walks and talks and that sort of thing. And we decided early on that it was just the facts. And that's what we really, really wanted to do. In the meantime, there was a group of people called the Children of Shenandoah who were descendants of displaced residents or some of the displaced residents themselves. And they had come together and were approaching the park with some requests about how they wanted us to tell their story. So when I first started working on the exhibit that is now at Bird Visitor Center, which is a huge, highly interactive exhibit that tells the story in complete detail. I mean, it's huge. The first thing we did was a temporary exhibit using their suggestions and input. And then we brought in people from the local governments and also people from the Children of Shenandoah to go through that temporary exhibit and then advise us on how to proceed. So the exhibit that you see at Bird Visitor Center today tells the story. It just lays it out. It's not interpreted. It just lays it out. And the exact quotes, some of the exact quotes that Mark used earlier that were pulled from that book that we've talked about a couple of times. Then we also pulled quotes from the same oral histories that, and there's one wall of these opposing quotes where the study says one thing, but the oral histories show something completely different. There's also been a commissioned archaeology study of the same three hollows that were studied in that ridiculous study, and the archaeology completely refutes anything that was in that book. And so the park supported that archaeology and published the book. It's called In the Shadow of Old Rag. And so there have been efforts over the last 20 years to really tell that story as accurately and completely as possible so that that we can honor the sacrifice that those people made. Whether the sacrifice was made willingly or not, the fact that there is a national park in our midst that people can enjoy on an almost daily basis as long as it's open, And the fact that that area is preserved in as pristine a condition as it is something that we can all be proud of, and particularly those people can be proud of their contribution to that and their sacrifice. And we feel like the way to honor that sacrifice is to tell that story as honestly as we possibly can.
Claire Comer is an interpretive specialist with the Shenandoah National Park. Bill Henry is one of the organizers of the group that calls itself the Blue Ridge Heritage Project, a group dedicated to honoring the memory of families forced out of their homes in the 1930s so that Shenandoah National Park could be created. Mark Purrington is digital content coordinator for James Madison University's Carrier Library, which now houses the Shenandoah National Park Oral History Collection. If you want to speak with any of them, we've got just a few minutes left to fit in phone calls, and we have lines open at 888-WMRA, talk in all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Mark Purrington from this oral history collection. I got to play at least a little tape of Etta Snow and her son Charlie. I think we're going to start at the place where the interviewer is asking about the use of herbs or what they did to fight sickness, and I think we'll get as far as where Charlie is talking about snakes. Having said that much, is there anything else you want us to know about Charlie and Etta before we hear their voices?
We believe that they were an African-American family, which were kind of rare in the Blue Ridge area. Another surprising thing is there's several interviews that speak of slave quarters or slave houses around some of the cabins, which was quite a revelation to me. I didn't realize that slavery had gotten into the Blue Ridge area as well.
So we start, I believe, with the voice of the interviewer, Dorothy Smith, and then we'll hear from Etta and Charlie.
Do you recall any of the herbs that were used when people got sick? Like, what did you do if somebody got a cold?
Well, I'd have to go to the store and buy something to well.
You didn't make these onion and meal poultices?
Yeah, no, some people did, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She used to give me kerosene and sugar for sore throat.
Kerosene and sugar? What did it taste like?
Oh.
Did it help the sore throat?
Oh, yeah, it helps it.
Yep.
Kerosene and sugar, sore throat.
I didn't think much of it.
Sounds as though she was trying to kill you.
Now, them mountains, you had a rough time of living up, and now you had to use anything you could.
That's right, sure. Yeah. How about a snake bite? What would you do for a snake bite?
I don't know what you do.
My cousin used to catch them, rattlesnakes and everything, trust me.
Yeah, put them in glass jars.
Very few people get bit by snakes in the mountains that lives there. It's the people that don't live there that want to get bit by them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're used to it.
Sure.
I used to run around these mountains barefoot, and I used to step on them. I'd jump 10 feet in the air when the thing stuck. Would slide under my feet.
Sure.
Scared me to death.
Yeah.
People in the mountains didn't get bit because they knew how to deal with the snakes. People who were visiting were the ones who got bit by the snakes, according to Charlie Snow from the Shenandoah National Park Oral History Collection. Let's go next to Woodstock. Glenn, thanks for calling in on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please, for our guests, Claire Comer, Bill Henry, and or Mark Purrington.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Wasn't the removal of people to create the national park also tied into the eugenics movement in the state of Virginia?
There was some tie-in.
This is Bill Henry.
I don't know all of the details, but I have read some things about that. And I don't know that there was, that we could say that the genetics or eugenics movement was a reason for it. I think that was something that came along. It was a popular idea, it was becoming a popular idea at the time. It was something
the,
that
the parallels perhaps were that the same people who had the idea that you help the poor by telling them how to run their lives, like taking them out of the mountains and putting them someplace that's better for them, you help what were then referred to as the mentally feeble by making sure that they did not have babies. And Claire, it looks to me like you had something you wanted to say about that.
Well, the state of Virginia had a eugenics program at that time, and it was administered through the welfare department. So the connection is if someone was in the welfare system, they were a candidate for eugenics. And so if some of the people who were residents of the parkland were to go into the welfare system, then they became it, and it no more so them than any other person who found themselves a part of the welfare system in the state of Virginia. But that was a horrible situation in the state as a result of misguided efforts to help people in the welfare system.
Glenn, thanks so much for that question. Next to Madison, Jimmy, you're on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please.
Yes, this is Jimmy Brown. I was one of the founding members of Children of the Shenandoah.
Hey, Jimmy. It's good to hear from you.
Hey, Jimmy. Glad you called.
Good to hear from you, Claire. I just want to give a thumbs up to the people at the park and the very helpful 25 years ago when I started being interested in this and talking with the people from the park. This was a skeleton in their closet that nobody wanted to talk about. And it has... they have come a long ways. The people at the park are more than helpful. The people at the archives are super. They will bend over backwards to help you with, you know, working on, you know, finding your families and the history. And I just, you know, just wanted to give them a big thank you for the, you know, the changes that have been made up there.
Well, we couldn't have done it without your help, Jimmy. That's for sure.
I am very proud to have been a part of it.
Thank you for your call, Jimmy. We have this on Facebook from Chris, who says, I'm so delighted to hear this collection celebrated. I picked it up from park headquarters so many years ago as JMU Special Collections Librarian. Processing it, which took years and many interns, taught me so much about our local history and has informed the books I've written about Appalachia. Thank you, Mark Purrington, for describing this collection so beautifully.
That's Chris Bolgiano, who was the Special Collections Librarian at the time we got the collection.
We're almost out of time, but Dennis in Massanutten, if you're quick, we can fit your call in.
Hi, I wanted to make you people aware that the Oak Ridge National Nuclear Facility down in Tennessee, there were people who were relocated to there from Shenandoah and got relocated again when the federal government took over three valleys much bigger than the Shenandoah National Park to conduct the Oak Ridge facility. and the nuclear effort there created the first atomic bomb that was used to help end the war.
Dennis, I'm seeing surprise on all three faces here in the studio. And if I could see mine in the mirror, I'd see surprise there, too. I don't think any of us knew that. Thanks so much for sharing that information with us. In the 30 seconds we've got left, Bill Henry, what do you want people to do or to know that hasn't been mentioned yet?
I just want people to understand that the park is more than just the trees and the rocks and the bears, that that there was the human history. And I hope that we can get more people to become interested in the human history of the park. For myself, when I started learning about the human life, the culture that was there before the park came, it really enriched my experience with the park, and I hope that everyone can have a part of that.
Our guests have been from the Blue Ridge Heritage Project, Bill Henry, from Carrier Library at James Madison University, Mark Purrington, and from the Shenandoah National Park, Park Service Interpretive Specialist. That's such a wonderful title.
Isn't it?
Claire Comer, thank you also very much for making time for us.
Thank you.
It was fun.
Insight's
thank
executive
you.
Producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers are Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. We also need to let you know that some of our break music is supplied by Robert Jusbay and Inner Rhythm. Let me also note that you can find postings of Virginia Insight when you go to WMRA.org, click on programs, and then click on Virginia Insight. And when you go to that page, you will see links to more information about each of our guests and the work that they are doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.